This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Jay Powell, the extended cuts on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, today, the 18th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Fed Chair Jay Powell, the floor is yours, sir.
We made one decision today, and that decision was to lower the federal funds rate by a quarter percentage point.
Okay, why?
We believe that action is appropriate to promote our objectives, of course.
Oh, stable prices and full employment being those objectives. But if this is Wednesday, a Fed chair's prognostication must come with a caveat. That's the rule.
We're going to be highly data dependent. As always, our decisions are going to depend on the implications of incoming information for the outlook.
Oh, look, here's another caveat.
Trade policy is not the business of the Fed. It's the business of Congress and the administration.
The words trade policy were, more often than not at this press conference, either preceded or followed by Chair Powell using the word uncertainty, which kind of explains this Federal Reserve mindset.
I think that the idea that if you see trouble approaching on the horizon, you steer away from it if you can, I think that's a good idea in principle. And I think history teaches us that it's better to be proactive in adjusting policy if you can. I think applying that principle in a particular situation is where the challenge comes.
Which gets us to this. Not everybody at the Fed thinks rate cuts right now are the way to go. And Powell, honestly, was pretty upfront about that.
This is a time of difficult judgments. And as you can see, disparate perspectives. And I really do think that's nothing but healthy. And I see a benefit in having those diverse perspectives, really.
That's thing one. The other thing is this.
It's a $22 trillion economy. To try to isolate the effects of certain things is very challenging, but we do the best we can.
He didn't actually shrug when he said that, but, you know, you could tell he wanted to. More from Jay Powell, and apologies in advance, but things are going to get a little bit weedy coming up in a bit. We turn now from the Fed to FedEx, our corporate story of the day. The global shipping giant from Memphis is singing the blues in the form of a glum quarterly report. It missed earnings targets for the quarter and lowered its outlook for this year. As Marketplace's Andy Euler explains, FedEx is facing a double whammy.
Whammy number one, a trade war full of tariffs. Teresa Fort teaches business at Dartmouth.
It's depressing demand for FedEx's services to ship that product.
In an earnings call on Tuesday, FedEx's CEO Fred Smith said trade disputes began to impact manufacturers in Europe and Asia in 2018. And he said that lowered demand for international shipping. Dale Rogers teaches supply chain management at Arizona State University. He says FedEx is also feeling some pain due to an anti-globalization movement around the world.
It's problematic for companies like FedEx, who have really been an enabler of global supply chains.
Those global supply chains are also affected by economic slowdowns. Helene Becker covers transportation for Cowen and Company.
FedEx again talked about the fact that they were seeing weakness in Italy, Germany, and France.
Not to mention the UK, where we're all wondering what's going to happen with Brexit. Okay, so you got whammy one, a global slowdown slash trade war. And then you got whammy number two, FedEx's divorce with Amazon. The company decided earlier this year not to renew its ground shipping and express contracts with Amazon. That's a $1 billion revenue hit alone. But Becker says FedEx's margins weren't great with Amazon, so they're looking elsewhere to fill that gap.
They're going after higher margin business like healthcare, pharmaceuticals, technology.
FedEx's Smith acknowledged that Amazon is increasingly a major competitor as it continues to develop its own delivery network. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Wednesday, as often happens on Fed days, traders and their algorithms were kind of all over the place. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Day 3 of the United Auto Workers strike against General Motors. Talks picked up again this morning at GM headquarters in Detroit. As of yesterday, the company said it's going to stop covering health benefits for workers on the picket lines. The union has stepped in to cover those costs, adding, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports now from Wentzville, Missouri, more stress to an already busy couple of days for union officials and striking workers.
Justin McCrico normally works in GM's trim department, putting carpets in vans and gear shifts in trucks. The past couple days, he's logged 13-hour shifts at the Union Hall, double-fisting cans of Mountain Dew.
That'll get me through 13 hours.
Why are you doing 13-hour shifts?
Because we have 4,500 people we need to register for strike benefits.
He says a team of 20 people signed up 1,700 workers yesterday, and they're trying to do 2,200 today, filling out paperwork so the union can pay for health benefits and so workers can get $250 a week in strike pay.
It was crazy yesterday, but it's been pretty decent. We've got an order to it now.
Healthcare benefits have reportedly been on the table in these negotiations, and that makes McCrico really nervous.
That's a big one for me. I had cancer, and my insurance paid over $2 million into my cancer care.
Healthcare is also a concern for Henry Crump, whose baby daughter has a heart condition. She goes to the hospital every couple of months. He says for all of the activity at the Union Hall, being on strike is a lot of waiting around.
You know, pretty much staying home, watching TV, watching news, and trying to stay away from spending money because money is going to be tight.
Strike pay for union workers doesn't kick in right away. Crump says he has savings and investment, but he doesn't want to spend any more than he has to. On the picket line outside the plant, Tony Jafrida was one of about 20 people waving blue and white signs at cars as they passed. He's concerned about GM's use of temporary workers and how they're treated, even though he's a permanent employee who's been at GM for 5 years.
They've been here for, like, almost as long as I've been here, and they don't have any benefits, and their pay is way lower, and no days off, no vacation.
He says it just doesn't feel right to do the same job as someone else, but be treated so differently. In Wentzville, Missouri, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Okay, back to Jay Powell and the Fed and the promised weediness. I'm going to play you some more audio of the chairman here talking about spiking interest rates in something called the overnight repo market.
This upward pressure emerged as funds flowed from the private sector to the Treasury to meet corporate tax payments and settle purchases of Treasury securities. To counter these pressures, we conducted overnight repurchase operations yesterday and again today.
So, kind of gibberish, unless you're steeped in the nuances of the financial system, right? But hopefully, you also know that if the chairman of the Fed decides to talk about it and we decide to talk about it, it kind of matters, right? Liz McCormick is at Bloomberg News, where, among other things, she covers the Federal Reserve and this repo market thing. Liz, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So I'm glad to have you, too, because we have to explain this thing called the overnight repo market. In as layman's terms as we can imagine, what is that?
Well, I think the best way to think about it is just like you and I can borrow money and go to the bank, institutional investors, big banks and asset management funds, they borrow and lend money and securities sometimes on a very short-term basis, sometimes maybe just for a day. And the overnight repo market is that, where banks may want to borrow money and big, huge money market funds may want to invest some of that money we all invest with them. So they do, in a sense, a swap.
Yeah.
These money market funds give the banks cash and the banks say, oh, thanks for that cash. We'll pay you interest. And to as collateral, you can take these Treasury securities. So they're just short-term loans.
And is it just to like settle up the books overnight? I mean, is that literally what it's for?
Not necessarily. Okay. Sometimes the banks and the dealers need the securities to settle books, but many times it's a way of getting financing for a lot of the banks.
So it's borrowing this money to make more money, right? Is that sort of the deal?
Right, exactly,
okay.
For sure.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened the past couple of days that the Federal Reserve had to jump in here? Because it seems to me that if this little mechanism doesn't quite work right, then there are what are called liquidity problems. People just don't have enough cash.
Right. Well, the repo market is something that, you know, always has its bouts of issues. Of course, during the financial crisis, it was Lehman partly having trouble getting their funding in repo that helped bring them, you know, to bankruptcy. But And we have special kind of, I'll call it seasonal factors at quarter end and year end when there's kind of some weird anomalies that make liquidity tough to find in the repo market. We had repo rates, like you said, kind of go crazy high, over 10%, which is well above, you know, what they normally are. And, you know, Chairman Powell spoke today in a press conference, and he said he feels strongly that, you know, what they did in the last 2 days worked. If they need to do more, they'll do it. But for now, he thinks that they'll do this as they need if it comes up again.
Okay, look, you mentioned Lehman Brothers and the end of the world repo issues that we had, I guess it's 11 years ago this month. You seemed kind of blasé when you were saying it. So can I impute from your tone that you're not that worried about this one?
Right. So I think we should all be clear to say this isn't like a big financial crisis. You know, it's about, you know, forces that are sapping liquidity, things that the Fed can address, is slowly addressing. There's some structural issues, let's call it, since regulators did a lot of things so the banks are safer. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is, let's be clear, it's not a big credit crisis looming. This is some kind of in the weeds of the what we call the wholesale funding market that helps institutional investors, you know, do what they need to do. And it is affecting the Fed's key rate. So that's why the Fed's involved.
So there is this overnight market. It got a little crazy. The Fed knows about it. But everybody calm down.
Yeah. And I think I would say let's not go that far to say it's over. The Fed is prompt, you know. People feel like maybe bigger action needs to be taken, and the Fed kind of promised they will. So we'll see how all that plays out.
Liz McCormick at Bloomberg News. Liz, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
Coming up.
I was just last week with the presidents of both Costa Rica and Colombia.
Just another day in the life of an American CEO, I guess. But first, let's do the numbers. So the Dow Industrials, after a volatile day where it dropped 200 points after the Fed's rate cut was announced, Dow finished up 36 points, 10%, 27,147. The Nasdaq shaved off 8 points, about a 10% there, 8,177. The S&P 500 edged up 1 point. We'll call that basically unchanged percentage-wise, 3,006. So with that Fed news, how about some banks? Bank of America deposited 0.2% today. Goldman Sachs found about a 0.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase up 1%. Talked about FedEx and worries about the global economy. FedEx down nearly 13% today. UPS dropped 0.1%. Amazon, just for the heck of it, off 0.2%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.79%. You're listening to Marketplace. You count on Marketplace to help you understand how the economy works and the way it affects our lives. As a nonprofit news organization, we count on listeners like you to support this kind of journalism. Think of it as an investment in your lifelong education. Any donation helps, and if you give today, you'll help unlock a $50,000 match from the Candida Fund. So please become a Marketplace investor at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Two things California now. First of all, Governor Gavin Newsom signed AB 5 today. That's a law we told you about last week that would oblige, among other things, Uber and Lyft to reclassify their drivers from independent contractors to employees. Also out here this morning, the Trump administration made it official that it's going to roll back a waiver that had let California set its own auto emission standards. The decision came as no surprise, nor will the legal fight sure to happen between California and the White House. But lawsuits aside, allow us to introduce you to a little thing economists like to call market forces. Justin Ho is on that one.
Back in July, California struck a deal with Ford, BMW, Honda, and Volkswagen. The automakers agreed to raise fuel standards to roughly 50 miles per gallon by 2026. Bruce Clark at Moody's says there's a clear reason the automakers signed on. It helps them plan.
One of the big issues with the auto companies is that they really do have to make product plans literally 10 years out into the future.
With China, Europe, and 13 U.S. states tightening their rules too, Clark says carmakers want clear and consistent fuel standards that work in all of their markets. Even though the Trump administration wants to do away with California's stricter rules, Michelle Krebs at Auto Trader says automakers are already committed to producing cars with higher fuel standards.
This isn't going to mean tomorrow they're all going to say, yippee, we get to build a whole bunch of gas-guzzling vehicles. No.
Consumers have also come to expect that new cars will have higher fuel standards and contribute less to climate change. Carla Balow is the CEO of the Center for Automotive Research.
Even though gas isn't that expensive right now, the customer's expectation, well over 65% of them are expecting that the fuel economy is going to continue to get better.
Depending on how you drive, Balow says higher fuel economy standards can mean real everyday savings.
With a new car price being a little bit north of $34,000, that total cost of ownership is part of that equation in a big way.
California plans to fight the Trump administration's decision. The case is expected to reach the Supreme Court. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Building homes got more expensive this year. Tight labor market, also tariffs, right? We've been telling you about that. Even so, home builders are feeling all right because lower mortgage rates should bump demand. Thank you, Jay Powell. Also, from the Census Bureau today came this nugget. Apartment and condo construction was up more than 30% July to August. Marketplace's Erica Barris spent her day finding out how renters are feeling about being renters.
34-year-old J.L. Johnson rents in Lee's Summit, Missouri. He's a technology manager for a healthcare company, and he figured the $100,000 he and his wife make should have been enough for a place he'd be happy with. They found a townhouse for about $1,000 a month, but
I think that's the part that's really discouraging. My wife and I do very well. We live in something comparable to what I lived in when I was 19 and moved out for the first time.
It's just sort of run down, Johnson says. He'd like to save up for a nicer place, but student loans and rising home prices are making that tough. For some renters, they aren't even considering buying. 37-year-old Katie Vance works as an executive assistant at a venture capital fund and pays $3,000 a month for a Manhattan studio. She says changing jobs and not knowing what the future may hold keeps her from buying.
I don't trust myself to buy. It's just, I don't want to say I'm a nomad, but I don't really know where I'd want to put down roots.
Michaela Crone is 29 and is a public relations manager in Pittsburgh. When she moved to the city, Crone had her pick of apartments. Buildings were offering all kinds of amenities, like a free month's rent. She pays $1,450 a month for a one-bedroom and has no plans of buying. For her, renting is more convenient, especially when things break and maintenance just shows up.
Ultimately, it saves me a lot of time and a lot of effort, so I don't have to worry as much.
Plus, she says, with some buildings doing so much to get people in, it's a good time to be a renter in Pittsburgh. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Pretty much everybody's back to school by now, I think. K through 12, certainly. College, maybe this weekend, the last batch goes. So this seems a pretty good time for this next interview. Jeff Majankalda is the CEO of Coursera. Online college education is what they do, one-off courses to full-on degree programs. He is also today's installment of our regular interview series, Conversations from the Corner Office. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here, Kai.
My guess would be that most people probably heard of Coursera back when it started in 2012, 2013, whatever, and what it was supposed to be back then. What is it today as you're running the company?
Well, it is pretty much what it started as, which is a company that's dedicated to trying to help educate the world. It was started by a couple of Stanford professors. And 7 years ago, it was clear that education would be a good thing. I think over the last 7 years, it's become clear that education is far more important than even people then thought, given how fast the world has been changing.
How are you doing that and making money, though, Jeff? That's the question.
Yeah, well, some people do wonder. And here's what it turns out. It turns out that we offer over 3,600 courses from some of the top universities and businesses in the world. You could take any of the courses for free. But if you want to get a certificate that says that you completed the course and learned the skills in the course, you pay about $49. That free piece draws in lots and lots of people. Mm-hmm. And even if a small percentage of them decide to buy it, it turns out to be a pretty decent business. And now we've expanded from offering just courses all the way to fully accredited master's degrees from some of the best universities like University of Illinois, University of Michigan, and University of Pennsylvania.
Do you think over time, does this way of learning and participating in higher education, does that replace the model today?
You know, I think it certainly complements it. But here's my prediction. I have a daughter who's a junior at Duke right now. I have two that already graduated from college. I think you're going to see a world shortly where almost all learning online and on campus actually happens online. I mean, we are at the verge of having almost all major universities put their courses online because students can learn in a much more adaptive, self-paced way. Lectures and lecture halls are things that will be not quite forgotten, but happily looked upon in the rearview mirror.
How do you do that, though, and fulfill what you set up at the top was the mission of this organization, right, which is to help the world learn? There are people who don't have access to the technology. There are people who have tried to figure it out who haven't. How come you guys are going to do it?
Well, you know, we're making really good progress. I was just last week with the presidents of both Costa Rica and Colombia, and they're talking about how to educate their citizens and make sure that their economy and their employment remain robust. What you find is that everybody's pretty much recognizing that connectivity is going to be key for any kind of economic success, because it will be the source of education and ultimately skills development and jobs. So I think the infrastructure comes from the government, the content and the credentials come from companies like Coursera.
Are we keeping up in this country with education?
You know, we just introduced something called the Coursera Global Skills Index. We actually rank all the learners in every country, and we publish this report. And what you find is that, you know, the U.S. is above the median. But surprisingly, it's not at the top of the list. The Scandinavian countries, the learners in Scandinavia on Coursera outperform the learners in the U.S. I think that that to me, when I look at the U.S., it is a study of extremes. A small portion of the American public in the really compelling institutions are doing extremely well and driving our economy. I think we have some work to do in making sure that more people get access to really good education and that these types of platforms like Coursera will be an important way to do it. I will say that every government that I'm talking to, we're now been hired by nine governments, they all believe that education will be the foundation of economic success or failure if you don't have skills to perform the jobs of the future.
Yeah. With the full disclosure that I've never taken a Coursera course, what was the last one you took?
I'm currently taking a course called Big History from University of Amsterdam. It's great. My favorite course on Coursera, which I would recommend to everyone, is Learning How to Learn. It's a course taught by a neurobiologist that teaches how your brain works and how you learn things and helps you be a little bit more efficient in the way that you learn.
I can do it for free, or do I have to pay for the certificate? Because, you know, $49 is $49.
Kai, if you don't need to prove to anybody that you completed the course, you could do it for free.
Jeff Maljankalda, he's the CEO of Coursera. Jeff, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
What you didn't hear in that bit or our interview, because we only get half an hour on the radio, right, was Jeff Maljankalda talking about taking Coursera public. Podcasts, though, as you know, can go on forever. Some of them do. You can find this interview and all the rest of our conversations from the Corner Office on our Corner Office podcast. This final note on the way out today, in which we return one last time to the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Jay Powell was asked today, as has become custom, about the slings and arrows he takes from President Trump on a regular basis. And Powell said, as has become custom, that the Fed doesn't do politics. But he was also asked, Ms. Powell was, about a presidential economic policy recommendation that has been tweeted of late, that the Fed ought to not just lower rates, but make them negative, says the guy who gets to decide.
I do not think we'd be looking at using negative rates. I just don't think those will be at the top of our list.
Not happening. Negative rates, of course, mean you would pay the government for the privilege of lending it money. Buying government bonds is the way that happens. Theory being you'd be more likely to spend the money out in the actual economy than just giving it to the government were rates negative. So there's that. Also, if I could do a little shameless self-promotion here, if you want to know how else the Fed keeps the economy running just right, what tools it uses, we did an explainer yesterday, the Fed set to music. Check it out, marketplace.org. All right, we're done. Dow Industrials up 36 points today, a 10% after some confusion after that Fed rate cut. The NASDAQ shaved off 8 points, about a 10%. S&P 500 basically flat on the day. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, J.C. Bold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.